Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We've got a packed show today. Christopher Metzler is going to be here talking about his film Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, an unusual documentary. Craig Varjabedian and Robin Jones are going to be here talking about their 4-20 photographs, stories from behind the lens, a book of photography and stories about New Mexican subjects. Right now, I would like to welcome Santa Fe's own Mayor David Koss and John Horning of Forest Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor Trump.
It's great.
Thanks. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here after quite a while. The Santa Fe River is flowing, ladies and gentlemen, and it's not just because of the rains. Why the push to keep it flowing even through drought periods?
Well, the Santa Fe River is the lifeblood of our community. It's why the city of Santa Fe is here. And I think maybe we've forgotten that the river sustains us. And I think the question that many environmental groups and the mayor are asking is, how can we sustain the river at the same time the river sustains us?
Now, is water taken from the river? I mean, obviously, you say Santa Fe is here because there's a river. All towns and cities exist near water sources. That's the definition of why we can, how we can survive. But how much water do we actually take from the river? Is that why the river has gone dry? Is because of human development?
I think to a large extent it is because of human development. We have two reservoirs up in the mountains, and the water that we hold behind those reservoirs makes about 40% of our drinking water in Santa Fe, or 40% of our water supply. I shouldn't call it all drinking water because so much of it is used for landscaping in Santa Fe. But starting with the construction of those reservoirs early in the last century, we started to change and dry out the Santa Fe River. And
so the water in the reservoirs would otherwise have flowed in the river.
Right, right. Would otherwise be flowing down the river. And then there's a complex set of reasons, you know, all the hardscape, all the parking lots, all the roofs. That water would have otherwise soaked into the ground and fed the river. Santa Fe downtown used to have a lot of springs that have been covered over, and as you pump the groundwater, the spring levels decline, the groundwater level declined. As you channelize the river and tried to make as much room as possible for development, you had a narrow and narrower river channel, and that started erosion. And since I was a young person in Santa Fe, the river right there by St. Francis eroded more than 25 feet. So we, for a complex set of reasons, we did a lot of things to the river.
When you say it eroded 25 feet, does that mean it's wider and wider?
No, it's deeper and deeper.
Uh-huh.
It's down in a canyon now. It used to be up at the level of Alameda almost.
Right.
And now it's 25 feet below that level. You know, that means that we drained our groundwater at least that much. And we just lost the structure of the river channel as a river.
And as it's got deeper and deeper, it's gotten narrower and narrower. And so as the water flows down the river, instead of spreading out its energy, its flow, it has less room to work with. And so that down-cutting process continues to occur. So unless we do something to
What's the disadvantage of that?
Well, it's not a river. I mean, a river is something that...
But, I mean, is it aesthetic? Is it ecological?
It's both.
It's all of the above. It drains the groundwater. The deeper the river channel cuts, because the river channel and the groundwater are connected in this part of town, the more you drain your groundwater, you make a... It becomes more and more dangerous. It's kind of like a giant fire hose. It's so narrow and focused that you have these torrents of water going through there. It becomes very ugly, in addition to dangerous. When we first started working on the river more than 10 years ago, you know, we were putting up signs and warning signs so people wouldn't fall into the off the side of the eroding cliffs.
Do you have that, little kids playing on the edge and going ka-thunk into the...
It's happened a couple of times, and big kids.
like us?
Yeah.
So is there a conflict between using the water? I mean, you we're going to talk in a second about the work that you're doing to keep the river flowing that involves, you know, buying water rights and using water to keep the river flowing. Is there a conflict between using it for the river and using it for human use?
Well, I think there's a balance to be found there, you know, and we're kind of coming to grips now with 100 years or so of water policy and water law. Adjudication of water rights in the Santa Fe Basin is started, but I think really there should not be a conflict. As John said, if the river doesn't exist, really neither does Santa Fe.
There shouldn't be a conflict, but I mean, are people, you know, you as mayor know better than the rest of us what happens when other people knock on your door and say, do this, do that?
Absolutely. There was a policy for the last 100 years of no water for the river and all of the water for the system. But if you really look at that, we grew out of that system about 1970 when we started drilling the Buckman well field. And so if you think of every household having a yard like you might in Illinois with the same kind of plants and vegetation and everybody using, you know, half an acre foot of water a year, we exceeded that about 1970. So I think there's really a lot of value for the community to have a living river and a lovely river, and that we're smart enough with our water use and our water policies to have water for ourselves to use in our households and our businesses, but also to have water in the river. But it's not easy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. I think it is a false dichotomy to think that it's either or. I think that the fate of our community is tied up in the fate of our river, and we need to see them as inextricably linked. And at the same time, I think we have some difficult choices to make as a community. We can't have it all, and we can't continue to grow at the expense of the well-being of the natural environment that sustains us. And one of the things that the city of Santa Fe is going to be unveiling here this next month, and I believe it's the first community in the West that has done this, is the Santa Fe River Fund. It's a Living River Checkoff. And so next month in July...
Living River Checkoff.
Yeah.
When you say checkoff, you're not referring to a Russian author.
No.
We're talking money, Mary Charlotte.
Well, what do you mean by checkoff?
Okay, so on your next monthly water bill, you normally, you know, the water bill is your opportunity to pay for your use of water. There will be an opportunity to add $1 per month or more that the city is very generously matching. And that money,
so you check a box on
you
your water
box.
Bill and put
yeah.
an amount that you would like to add to your
yes.
to your expense.
Yep. This is check OFF, not check OV.
Okay.
And the city, again, has generously agreed to match all of those contributions, and those contributions will go towards helping acquire water rights for the river, because right now the river doesn't have any water in its name. And so the purpose of the fund is to reclaim the river's rights to its own water.
And so where, and this is, of course, the $64 question or whatever amount we're up to now, million-dollar question, where do those water rights come from?
Well, some of them, you know, the best water rights would come from the Santa Fe River Basin, but those are not, those are under adjudication right now, so it's unclear exactly how many will be available. But, for example, we were looking at some water farm or ranch down in La Cienega that the Trust for Public Land is working to acquire that has some water rights with it. The idea might be to purchase those water rights and make sure they stay in the river down there in La Cienega and use them as offset rights for water use further upstream. Then some water rights could come from through our Buckman Direct Diversion Project eventually when that is built. So they'd be Middle Rio Grande water rights. I think the other real important thing to do, though, is start to dedicate part of our current water supply. Say we are going to have that in the river.
Now, let's talk, John Horning of Forest Guardians, about the ecological destruction and potential restoration around the Santa Fe River?
Sure. Well, as David said, this is a process that's been occurring for more than 100 years. And so I think the key thing for people to realize is that we're not going to restore a bubbling trout stream tomorrow. This is going to take a lifetime of commitment. Rivers die the death of a thousand cuts, and they need to be restored one day at a time by...
A thousand drops.
Yes. Yeah, and so it's going to take...
We're so literary this morning.
I don't know what's wrong.
So it's going to take... You know, there are all sorts of projects that the city has been doing with youth, the Youth Corps group, planting cottonwoods and willows, building grade structures to allow the river to essentially re-grade. Those have been important. And really what we're talking about is kind of having a string of pearls from upstream, downstream, and over time those areas will be reconnected. I've heard you too talk, Mayor, about, you know, maybe initially it will just be a set of pools where there is aquatic life that can live in those pools. And again, over time, as we have more of a cottonwood willow forest and an intact ecosystem, that area can keep its water for a longer period rather than drying out as is the case currently.
Now, I mean, it's a long process. If fish were to come back to the river, would fishing be prohibited?
Well, you know, we're so far, I think, in at least certain reaches from
we don't have to worry about that
sustainable
yet.
Fishery. We haven't crossed that yet. I think what John was talking about, you know, I think a more near-term goal would just be to have some aquatic life, maybe not vertebrate life like fish yet, but just to start the food base for fish and to start, if you really got to where you had aquatic life, aquatic insects, it would be quite an accomplishment for that middle reach from like Alameda down to San Ysidro. That's, you know, there's no aquatic life now because the water's just not persistent enough to support, you know, even water striders or something like that. So, you know, that's a more near-term goal, to have at least some of that starting to come back. But it really starts, like John says, with stabilizing the grade of the river, starting to bring the river back up, and having the riparian system, the cottonwoods and willows and plants near stream, have enough wetted time where there's water in the river, or at least water in the shallow aquifers, to support that vegetation.
So all of this can be aided by people putting a little bit more money into their water bill.
A dollar a month.
A dollar a month.
That's
all
we're
asking. A big difference.
I think it will over time. Part of it is creating the popular, demonstrating that there's popular support. We can translate that into political will. And political will is financial capital. And all of those things, popular grassroots support, political leadership that the mayor's provided, and financial capital are ingredients. No, any one of those things in isolation is not going to get it done. But together, all those things can help slowly restore the river. One of the things that I want to add just briefly is we've been working on a stretch of river below the wastewater treatment plant where the river becomes perennial again. And this area of the river has come back to life. And there are beavers that are coming back. And beavers really captivate the public's imagination. Every year that we have a big flow, there's always a front page story when a beaver is spotted in the channel. And if we can provide the flow and the vegetation, who knows? Maybe one of these years in the decades looking forward, a beaver dam will be created. And then, again, that the beaver dam naturally holds water in place and holds sediment in place. And suddenly people will... It's like a magnet. People come back to the river.
Right.
And
it's one of the things I love about living in Santa Fe. It was quite shocking when I moved here. Animal stories on the front page of the paper. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you both for being here. John Horning of Forest Guardians and Mayor David Koss. And this is something that we will continue to follow on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Really nice to be here. And I just want to thank everybody like the Forest Guardians and the Watershed Association that are just helping us, you know, put the river as a priority for this community.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Chris Metzler. He is director, co-director of the film, the documentary Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, which screens tonight at 7:30 at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Mary Charlotte. How are you doing?
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, definitely so. Last time I was here, it was via payphone in the middle of the desert giving you a call in the morning.
We talked about another version of this film at one of the past Santa Fe film festivals, and you were trying to get to Santa Fe, couldn't quite make it, and we're talking to us from the desert. But we're having you on again because you are doing a theatrical release of this very strange, interesting, funny documentary, which is narrated by John Waters, who's the perfect person to do it. What is the Salton Sea?
The Salton Sea is this accidental salt lake about an hour south of Palm Springs. In the 50s and 60s, it was a booming, thriving resort area. But after a series of apocalyptic disasters that struck there in the 70s, the area's basically been abandoned. In a way, it's a 1950s or 60s suburban ghost town. And so, of course,
when you say apocalyptic disasters...
Well, especially given the theme of the program that's going on at CCA, is that it's a lot of environmental issues, in particular fish die-offs, where you'd have several million fish die in a day, some flooding, and then, of course, bird die-offs. And, of course, that's not the sort of place that most people often choose to resort. And so those kind of
three things. No, the smell alone would keep you away.
And the smell gets quite bad sometimes, in the sense that, but there is kind of a surrealness to the Salton Sea, in the sense when you see these half-flooded buildings and these kind of some crisp fish carcasses on the shoreline, it kind of looks like a nuclear test site, or in a way a Salvador Dali painting come to life. And of course, that's what fascinated us to go down there. And of course, once you learn about the history and the environmental issues of the area, you realize that those stories need to be told also.
Now, was the Salton Sea a man-made phenomenon in the first place, or was it a real existing body of water?
No, it was just an empty, dry desert valley. In fact, the Salton Sink, where the Salton Sea is now, was actually lower below sea level than Death Valley. But once a dam broke that was built to help irrigate the deserts in the early 1900s, it filled up the Colorado River basically for 2 years, flooded this valley, and created the Salton Sea. And
so it was an inadvertent man-made sea.
Absolutely. And it's one of the largest catastrophes, actually, in American history. But, of course, very few people know about it just because it kind of happened in the middle of nowhere. But the creation of the Salton Sea allowed not only this thriving recreational area in the 50s and 60s, but also a lot of the farming that goes on in Southern California nowadays.
There are some really weird moments in the documentary. One of them is something which you think of as, what would you call it, weird satire, which is a real estate agent looking at a map of lots of little tiny suburban plots of land and trying to sell them to people.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing about it is that I think one of the difficult things to understand about the Salton Sea nowadays in reflection is that a lot of the people that live at the sea saw it during its heydays. And so they saw this promise in the sense that it really competed with Palm Springs in the 50s and 60s. And in a way, there's actually more visitors to the Salton Sea than Yosemite National Park until the mid-70s, which is really difficult for me to fathom just because how popular Yosemite National Park is. So when you see these real estate agents that are selling all these empty lots with roads and palm trees and things, you think, well, this must be crazy. But, of course, they're living in the life that they saw the promise at some earlier point in time and are trying to kind of restore the Salton Sea to its earlier glory.
But, the surrealistic aspect of it is these people are living a dream world that no longer exists.
Absolutely. And, it's not that it's not possible, but I guess... obviously, with all the growth that we've had in the West in the last 30 years, is that, water's become this very valuable resource. And so, in a way, as the growing coastal cities in California and San Diego and Los Angeles, and of course also Las Vegas and Phoenix, want more water from the Colorado River, they say, well, why are we letting all this water flow into the Salton Sea? It's just considered a waste. And so the problem is that the Salton Sea's become a refuge for birds along the Pacific Migratory Flyway. And so, while a lot of the people of the Salton Sea want to save the Salton Sea for recreational purposes, environmentalists are now coming on board and saying, hey, look, the Salton Sea is important for these birds. And so that'll be the difficult thing to figure out, is to balance out the needs of basically development in the West with the birds and the wetlands they depend on. Because there aren't very many wetlands left in Southern California, and
So before the dam break, the birds used other wetlands, which now have been filled in.
Yes. Basically, at the turn of the century, before Los Angeles and San Diego and other parts of the West built up, there were numerous wetlands that the birds stopped at. But by the 1970s, most of the wetlands in Southern California disappeared, and the birds of the Salton Sea said, hey, well, the Salton Sea will work out. There's fish here, there's wetlands, and in a way, during the wintertime, you can see basically about 75% of the different types of birds that are on the Pacific Migratory Flyway. It's a big bird-watching area in a way.
It does bring up the question of what happens when you create oases that are unnatural, whether you can really sustain them.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the craziest things about it is that, I have my own affection for the Salton Sea just because the people that live there, kind of live on the fringe of society and are trying to do things differently. And so in a way, I kind of value their water needs more so than, let's say, a golf course or, washing my car. But with that said, you have a lot of these large populations like San Diego and Los Angeles that, in a way, are unsustainable. I mean, there aren't supposed to be these large communities here in the middle of the desert. I mean, if you took away the water, the Salton Sea would look, the Los Angeles area would look a lot more like, Palm Springs in that way. And so I think that's one of the, growing challenges here in the next few decades, in the sense of that, can these communities really, or these large megalopolis cities, continue to exist? And, of course, people of the Salton Sea want their own fair share, too, and they want Los Angeles out at the, at the Salton Sea also.
The document, we're talking to Chris Metzler, and the documentary is called Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, narrated by John Waters. It has a real 1950s aesthetic that you used in the typeface and in the music and so on in this documentary. How did you strike that balance between making a real information-packed documentary and something that was just weird and funny?
Well, I think we were more inspired by Errol Morris's documentaries like Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, or even
right.
Fog of War. And we kind of just liked the idea of, allowing the visual aesthetic of the film to reflect, the story itself. I mean, that's how most films are made. Unfortunately, most documentaries aren't. And so we felt that, since we're drawn by the people and the portraits of the people who live along the shores of the Salton Sea, we started kind of peeling back these layers. And so as we got familiar with the environmental issues and the history, we understood that you couldn't understand the people in their lives without understanding the environmental issues. And so while we're not activist filmmakers per se, at the same time we recognize the importance of the environment, not only to the greater community at large, but also to the people of the Salton Sea. And in a way, I guess it's a hybrid film. It's a kind of a quirky, offbeat midnight movie that happens just to be real. And then, of course, it's an environmental issue oriented documentary exploring basically, this kind of microcosm of the American dream, I guess, in the sense of, the needs of, sprawling growth, I guess, in water. And, of course, the reality that, not every, environment can, sustain that.
I like it for a number of reasons, and one of them is because you don't have to be super earnest to enjoy it. What are the people who do? What are the people who live there? What do they do for a living?
Well, most of the people that live at the Salton Sea are on some sort of financial assistance. So that's about 75% of them are senior citizens, people that retired to the sea in the 60s or 70s and either got stuck there or have decided to stay because they really love the area. And the other 25% are a new group of more often young African-American families that are leaving areas like South Central Los Angeles and felt that it was too dangerous to raise their kids and chose to move to the Salton Sea because it was a more idyllic life.
And the real estate prices were not very high.
Oh, it's one of the cheapest places in all America, which is an unusual thing to find in California, of course. And so a lot of the people there are no jobs. There really isn't any sort of infrastructure. So most people either live on Social Security or welfare or other forms of government assistance. And that's just based out of necessity, not out of choice. I mean, in a way, you really are – they are living in this small little island, in the middle of the desert. And, Palm Springs is about an hour away. Any other larger community is about an hour south. And so – about half of the residents don't own cars, kind of drive around in golf carts in one particular community, and are kind of trying to grow their own community there. The few people that do have outside jobs either work as domestic servants or in kind of more of the service industry in Palm Springs, and they couldn't afford to live in Palm Springs, and that's one of the reasons why they decided to live in in the Salton Sea, because you know, on the wages they were earning as, you know, domestic servants and things, they had to, you know, live an hour away and commute each day.
So the film is called Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea. We won't give away the whole film. Chris Metzler is joining us. He is co-director of the film. It's narrated by John Waters, and it screens tonight at 7:30 at the Center for Contemporary Arts. You are taking it around the country right now?
Yeah. Basically, we opened up theatrically here in Los Angeles in the middle of April, and since then we've been kind of going on a road tour with the film from then until basically this fall, and so it's kind of nice and exciting to be back in Santa Fe. So just came from Tucson and Phoenix, and then today Santa Fe at the CCA, and then later in the week in Albuquerque before I jet across the country to Florida and Georgia.
All right.
It's kind of like a punk rock band, I guess.
Almost. Chris Metzler, thank you so much for joining us here at the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Thanks again, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Craig Varjabedian and Robin Jones. Craig is a photographer, and Robin is the author, writer of the text for the book, 4 and 20 Photographs, Stories from Behind the Lens, published by UNM Press. And they will be speaking and signing books this Friday at 5 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to have you here.
Thanks.
Now, you are a photographer, and there you chose 24, or maybe the two of you chose 24 of your photographs to not only present, but really talk about what the story was behind them. How did you start the collaboration?
Well, I think it's really started with the photographs. It was sort of a delicate balance between how good the images were and how good the stories were at the same time. And it kind of whittled it down because it was much larger in the beginning. It probably at one point was over 75 photographs. And then we kind of whittled that down and eventually got it down to a number that was sort of manageable. And then I started basically telling the stories to Robin. And then Robin sort of brought her magic to the table.
Well, Craig has been telling these stories for years. He teaches workshops, photography workshops, and he'll show his pictures to tell the stories, and people go, oh, Craig, that's a great story. You know, you got to write that down. And I don't know how many years people have been telling this to Craig, but then...
And then you did it.
When I started hearing the stories, I said, wow, I'm going to write them down. And
you're so very kind.
That's how we kind of got started with it, and it has been such a collaborative mix of not only the photographs and me putting them down on text, but then gathering the information that surrounds the rest of the atmosphere, the rest of the environment of the photograph, the history, the geography, the people in the photographs. And it's just such a tremendous combination of the image and the imagination that looks at the photograph. So, you know, I think it's a good pairing. It's a good collaboration.
Now, you do mostly black and white photograph, mostly gelatin silver print as opposed to digital. Is that correct? There's a few exceptions.
A large part of the work I do is traditional black and white, like you say, and with silver and film and regular gelatin silver paper. A couple of the images, though, in the book were done in color and were done digitally. And that may be, for me at least, the wonderful boon that digital photography offers is that it provides a way for me to access color in a way that was much more difficult in the past with having to do color photography by way of the silver process, if that makes any sense.
Right, right, right. Well, it's interesting because I was reading through the book. The cover photograph is a color photograph of a cowboy, a horse, a very vibrant adobe wall, and then in the book it's black and white. And at first, before I read the story, I was like, what's going on here?
Well, we thought that it offered a certain continuity to present the all of the photographs in the interior of the book in black and white, that it sort of, we just sort of saw a lovely similarity. And I think, too, that the images, I think a true test of a good image is that it will hold up without the color added to it. In other words, it will hold up as a black and white image as well. And I would make a strong argument that the two color images, which are reproduced on the covers front and back of the book, in black and white hold up well.
Now, there seem to be so many different schools of photography in the way that photographers work. Some people take a zillion images and choose among them. You seem to be more of the school that takes one picture, or maybe two or three, very carefully composed and light metered and so on. Talk more about that.
Well, it looks that way, I suppose, but once I have some clear idea of what I'm trying to photograph, then a lot of times it's a matter of waiting for the moment to unfold. So a lot of the images that you see in the book may actually have had, you know, many pieces of film exposed, because if you're photographing a storm, let's say, over a corral, such as we did in the book, you know, there's a point where the moment sort of reaches a kind of a crescendo, and it's really that precise moment, borrowing from the idea that Cartier-Bresson talks about in terms of decisive moment. It's really that precise moment, or that decisive moment, I'm really looking to achieve in the picture.
And so in these stories about a storm or cloud patterns or sunset or whatever, weather changing over a scene, do you know what you're looking for? Like, in a few minutes, the sun is going to come out and it's going to look like that, and then you're going to take the picture?
I wish it were that easy.
That seems impossible.
Yeah, no, I don't really. But I know that I'll make a photograph and I'll go, and I'll be kind of watching the scene as it changes. I go, oh, well, that's pretty interesting. And in some ways, it almost feels like it's becoming stronger in some way, more powerful. And so I'll photograph that moment. And then sometimes the moment may just completely fall apart, and there may be nothing more after that. Sometimes what happens is that the storm will, as using the storm as an example, the storm will pick up and it will get more and more. Then the sun will break. But you can't predict any of that on the front end.
So you wait.
So I wait.
Do you use a large format
I do.
Camera?
Yeah, I use a 5x7 view camera, which is a camera that uses film that's 5x7 inches. It's like what you see the traditional photographer using, sort of a camera with a lens on the front and a place for the film in the back and a sort of an accordion bellows in between.
And do you put your head under a black cloth?
I do, yeah.
Well, that's the old school.
Yeah, and in fact, the image is actually inverted, so everything I photograph in here, I actually look at upside down.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
Does that help you see the composition in a more abstract way?
Well, I think what happens is after time is that you don't really see it upside down anymore. You see it actually, your mind sort of corrects it.
It's like those baby chicks who put the little glasses on that makes them see upside down.
Yeah. But I think that certainly, you know, when I look at my finished pictures in the darkroom, I'll actually turn the prints back upside down and actually look at them and see if they hold up well. And it's a nice test. I've heard painters doing this a lot in terms of making sure their compositions are strong. They'll invert the painting upside down so that it, you know, to test to see if it's good.
We're talking to Craig Varjabedian and Robin Jones. The book is called 4 and 20 Photograph Stories from Behind the Lens, published by the University of New Mexico Press. There is an element of documentary in the work, too, as opposed to fine art prints. I suppose the two go together. But what are some of the documentary... I mean, I was thinking about the Moradas, the Penitente work. Do you consider it documentary?
Well, yes and no. I think that in terms of the Morada work that I did, there was a desire to record all of those places. But at the same time...
What are the Moradas?
The Moradas are the sanctuary meeting houses of the confraternity of Our Father Jesus the Nazarene, and what people sort of commonly know here in New Mexico is the Penitente Brotherhood, one of the oldest Catholic organizations here in at least New Mexico, and certainly the United States. They built chapter meeting houses throughout most of northern New Mexico and up into southern Colorado. And I set off years and years ago to sort of document these buildings because they'd never been documented before. And it created a large body of work. But what I began to discover as I was creating documents of things, records of this building and this place, was that I was being affected by what I was looking at. And so all of a sudden, yes, the images are documentary, but I would make the argument that they also evoke something, you know, so they're not just a
In that religious, spiritual way that is contained in them as religious places, or?
I think I think it does that. Certainly if you come from a traditional Catholic background, you I think you get a sense of that. But I think I've shown the photographs to people who come from a Buddhist tradition and a Muslim tradition, and they get that something else is going on here. And I love the idea of that. And it's not necessarily something I think that I put into the pictures in some way. I think it's more something that's already there, and I was given a glimpse of.
That you're responding to.
Yeah, and it shows in the picture. And so it, as a photographer, you end up putting that into the image.
Now, there's an image in the book, a moonrise over a Penitente Morada, reminiscent of Ansel Adams' famous photograph. But the making of those two photographs, Ansel Adams' photograph and yours, couldn't be more different.
They really are, yeah. His was, you know, he was driving down that highway back in towards Española, and he saw the moon rising
over
the mountain.
Screeches to a halt.
There you go. You know the story. In my case, I had a dream. You know, I had a dream. I had a dream about it and saw this moon rising over it. And so, we kind of write about that a little bit in the book and in more detail. But I think the point I want to make only is that I then set off to figure out how I could make a photograph that sort of corresponded in some way to this dream I had, as a way of sharing it.
And so you actually measured the angle of the moon and what day it was going to come to a place where it was this height over the... I mean...
I learned a lot about astromechanics.
It just was so striking. I mean, so is Ansel Adams one of your great influences?
I would say not necessarily in a visual way, although I certainly could see, you know, the traditional print as an influence from him. I'd met Ansel Adams when I was a little boy, and it really was kind of that chance meeting with him that sort of actually pointed at me and said I ought to become a photographer. And so, yeah, there is a strong influence. I also worked for the photographer Paul Caponegro when he lived here in town, and I think he was probably a stronger visual influence.
Who are your other artistic influences, whether they be photography or otherwise?
Oh, my goodness. That's a really good question. I'm really fascinated by the luminist painters, you know, sort of the Hudson School painters. Although at the same time, I also really love the Taos painters as well. I love the quality of light that they capture in their images. And I think that you know, especially when it comes to photography, you know, light is everything. And so in my images, what I'm looking for is a sense of that light, and then trying to sort of share the quality of that light through the photograph itself.
Now, there's some very, I don't know, strikingly funny images. I almost laughed when I saw one of the Archbishop Michael Sheehan among the flock of sheep in full garb, and then reading your story, Robin, about how the sheep didn't really want to be around him, and so the archbishop was being abandoned by his flock. It just cracks me up.
Well, that was one of my favorite stories, and it's a wonderful story in the book, but you still have to watch Craig, you know, late at night, sitting around the kitchen table, talking about it and acting out all the parts, except for that of the sheep. And it's... again, one of those stories that has a long background, because he was working on another book and had met the Archbishop through that, and eventually started to think, you know, I really need a picture of the Archbishop in this book, and I want to take a meaningful picture, because Craig and the Archbishop have developed a very special friendship. And he had seen other pictures of former archbishops, which are, you know, very formal, very polite, and nothing that captured what to Craig was the warmth and the humaneness of Archbishop Sheehan. So I don't know if it was another dream or not, but he thought it would be beautiful to have him with his flock in the natural scene of New Mexico, out in the wilderness. Though it's kind of hard to get the Archbishop out there in all his full regalia and with everything that he has to carry. And they were lucky enough to find a place where he didn't have to wander up into a pasture where there were sheep, but of course once they finally got there, and this is of course after he had finally convinced the Archbishop, yes, this will be a good picture, yes, it will not be, you know, disrespectful. And in fact, the Archbishop now really enjoys the picture, and I believe talks about it and uses it, but to get him there and then to get Craig situated and get them at the right height and get the light right and get the wind right, and then those blasted sheep don't want to cooperate. So luckily, our good friend and particularly one of Craig's mentors, Floyd Trujillo, was there with a bag of corn and sprinkles it all around the Archbishop. And if you look closely at the photograph, you can see that vague little circle of corn. And the sheep just rush right towards the Archbishop then.
So. Well, we won't talk about the metaphors inherent in that. But the it is also funny that the little neighborhood children say to their, "Mommy, Mommy, the Archbishop is in the pasture." And their mother says, "Go to your room for lying." "No, no, really."
It doesn't happen every day.
She was just as surprised as the grandchildren were when she looked out the window and saw them there too.
So you do some portrait photography, more what we might call inanimate objects, landscapes and buildings, and really New Mexico places.
I do, but I think people are inextricably. You know, intertwined with the built environment, and so people have become a large part of my sort of photographic body of work.
There's a photograph of Pedernal Mesa, which of course is famous because George O'Keefe painted it over and over. Mm. What is it? I mean, there's an inevitable association with O'Keefe when you make a picture of Pedernal Mesa. Does it feel that way to you?
No. O'Keefe wanted to own the Pedernal, first of all. You know, she talks about, you know, if she painted it long enough, God would give it to her. You know, I never felt the need to own it particularly. I like looking at it, and I like to think that other people can look at it, and there is a big fence around it. You know, I think that one of the tough things one has an artist as a photographer, you know, is that invariably when you photograph the moon rising or you photograph the Pedernal or you photograph some icon that some other artist really explored through their work, you become in some ways perhaps guilty by association, you know. I guess I just kind of refuse to look at it that way, that if I do that, then all of a sudden I'm going to cut myself off from everything I ever photographed, because there are plenty of photographers who photograph flowers, and there are plenty of photographers who make portraits, and there are plenty of photographs of people who took pictures of clouds, and so on and so forth. And so I have to keep that out of the side of my brain that tells me photograph this or photograph you or photograph whatever.
Right. We're talking to Craig Varjavedian and Robin Jones about the book 4 and 20 Photographs, Stories from Behind the Lens. You are out there with your very big camera, mm-hmm. then you go into the dark room.
Mm-hmm.
Are those two parts of the process equally important? How do you see the interaction with one another? You obviously do your own printing.
I do. I print everything myself. They're inextricably intertwined. One really, it's impossible for one to really happen without the other. I've tried. When I was shooting more color in an analog way, you know, giving my images to the photo lab and having them print them, but there are subtle things that happen in the darkroom that come through the process of actually having to deal with the image and seeing it and watching it change as you do certain manipulations in the darkroom, that it's extremely difficult to explain to someone who's trying to print it for you. So I find I have to do it myself. And the other thing I also find really interesting is that I might make a 6 or 7 prints of a given image on Monday, and a month later I may come back and print that image again, and the image will take me somewhere else, depending upon where I'm at a given moment, where I'm at emotionally, or where I'm at, or as I look at the image, I may say, oh, maybe that this little area of the photograph needs to be stronger. And so while photography is a duplicable process, you can make as many prints as you want to from a negative, I find that the prints I made 10 years ago are different from the prints that I made last week.
In what way?
I think that my vision becomes, or my feeling about a particular image becomes informed over time. You know, there's a wonderful expression that Sadie Lombardi, who's a lady we photographed in the 4 and 20 book, talks about, and she talks about when they're training horses, they have to allow things to kind of soak, you know, in the training process. And I find that the image continues to act upon me over time. So the way I may print one of these images in this book today will probably be different when I print it in another year. Because what that image is informing me about will have changed me in some way.
And for our listeners who've never done darkroom printing, it just shows that there is so much that's done with the raw material of the negative once you get into the darkroom. It's by far not a finished artwork.
It really isn't. The one of the great things that Ansel Adams is attributed to saying is he talks about the negative being the score and the print being the performance. And I guess my performance gets better over time. Much in the way a pianist will develop with a piece of music that they begin to know.
Now, Robin, I have to ask you, did you get inspired to start making photographs yourself while working on this book?
Yeah, Robin.
Thanks for asking. No, I'm still photo illiterate, which I think is a safe and sane thing to be when you're writing for a photographer, and especially for one such as Craig, who, as I say in the foreword of the book, he really loves photography, loves to talk about it, but really would prefer to kind of stay away from the nuts and bolts. If you want to talk to him about f-stops, he'll be happy to, but it's not where his heart is. And I'm not quite sure what an f-stop is. I think it's, maybe a musical thing. I don't know. But it leaves us both in a place where we talk about image and process without so much the technology. And he explains the technology in language. Well, he explains the technology, and I render it in language that I can understand, and that if I can understand it, I'm assuming most people can understand it. The real photographers are rolling their eyes and going, no, this is not like this. This is much more something. But I think we've resolved into a kind of a nice language so that when he'll talk about something, I kind of know what he's talking about, but I don't know the nuts and bolts of it.
Well, I find that a nice quality of the book, which is that the technical nerdy part of the process is really in service to the image and to the artwork.
I'm so pleased you saw it that way.
And on that note, we have to go. Craig Barjavidian and Robin Jones have created this wonderful book, 4 and 20 Photographs, Stories from Behind the Lens, published by the University of New Mexico Press, and they will be speaking and signing books this Friday at 5 o'clock, what did I say?
At the CCA.
Oh, at the CCA.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Collected Works
Bookstore.
There you
go.
Oh, thank you for telling me that. At Friday at 5 o'clock at the CCA, and we will see you there. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night that you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Clifford Brown. And Giants of Jazz presents the fourth installment of the tribute to Duke Ellington, including an interview with jazz singer Joan Watson Jones. Excerpts from the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival will also be heard. All this and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. We'll see you tomorrow. Hey, we'll be talking about healthcare in America tomorrow. Lots of fun. Bye.